First, I just wanted to say that Rav just asked me about this. Sfarim are not necessary. If you want to have a sefer and follow along, you might find that helpful, but you don't really need to have a sefer. Okay. Before we begin learning the sefer, there's a few introductions that are in place. First of all, just in general, before we even start discussing what Kuzari is, there's famous intrigue around the origin of the sefer, which I kind of feel like we have no choice but to address. The reason I say we have no choice but to address this is because it really isn't really a very important part of what we're trying to do here. When you're told that you need to take a certain medicine, and you know that the medicine works, you're not so interested in how the company that produced this medicine started. You're interested in what the medicine does for you. The main thing we're going to be getting out of this sefer is what it's going to be doing for us and our Yiddishkeit. But since Lamaisa, this is something that you almost can't get away from, the whole discussion of how the Kuzari originated, spend a few minutes on that, stressing that it's not really all that important, and then we'll actually move on to begin the subject. So first of all, the structure of the Kuzari is probably most of you are familiar with the structure of the Kuzari. The Kuzari is a debate. The Kuzari is a debate, or more accurately, a dialogue between the king of a place called Kuzar. That's why it's called Kuzari, the Melech Kuzar, Kuzari king, and a Jewish Chacham. This was a king, we'll see the exact story when we actually begin the Sefer. This king was a very conscientious person, a very sincere person, and he was searching for the truth. He was searching for the truth. The Sefer begins with him, didn't even think of approaching the Jewish people. He was sure that the Jews don't have it. They're just a downtrodden and pathetic nation. He started by talking to first philosophers, which kind of translate in modern day terms into the atheists, then with a representative of each the Christian and Muslim faith, basically makes short shrift of them, then moves into his discussion with the Chacham, which basically constitutes most of these pages, minus maybe the first three. No, more than that, but okay. So the way the Sefer is presented is, we want to see exactly who put the Sefer together. So the Sefer says, Yehuda ben Shaul said that the author said that this is how Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri presented arguments to the king of Kuzar. So we already have three players here. There's Yitzchak ben Shaul, there's the author, and there's Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri. If we're going to just take it at face value, what actually happened was, there was a Jew by the name of Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri who actually had this debate with the king. 400 years later, the author put it together. The author is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. He's the person who actually wrote Sefer HaKuzari based on a debate that took place 400 years earlier between Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri and the king of Kuzar. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote the Sefer in Arabic, and it was translated by Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Tibbon. So that's the understanding of Yehuda ben Shaul is the translator to Hebrew. He says, the author said, you should have a chair. Okay. The translator is Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Tibbon. He tells us that the author, that's Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, said this, and he's citing the debate between Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri and the king of Kuzar. That's if we're going to take it at face value. But many... Okay. Who wrote the notes of the original dialogue? So really the truth is that the Kadmainim, when they're trying to really identify who the author is, they really break it into three possibilities, not two. Possibility number one is the way I just presented it. Rabbi Yitzchok HaSangeri had his debate. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi recorded it. And then it was translated. That part is not debated. It was translated into Hebrew by Rabbi Yehuda Ben Tibon. By the way, just in parentheses, this we should have respect for the translator. The Ebon Tibon family produced some of, translated some of the most fundamental Sfarim that we have. Chavis Alvavis is Rabbi Shmuel Ebon Tibon. It's all the same family. So that's possibility number one. Possibility number two is that there never was a debate between the Jewish Chacham and the King of Khuzar. It was just this was the style that many people wrote books in those days. A fictional debate. It was presented that way just to make it a little more interesting. So Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri put this work together. He told the story of the debate, which was really fictional. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi put it into writing. That's possibility number two. The debate never happened. Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri came up with the whole story. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi put it together. Possibility number three is that there never was a Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangeri. And no debate ever took place. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi authored the whole thing telling a story. He did what we just described. He told the story of a debate that Ki'ilu happened 400 years ago. But the whole thing was really, he originated it and he put it together. That's the second point of intrigue. The first point of intrigue is who wrote this work. Second point of intrigue was there really a King of Khuzar? Especially since, as it unfolds here, it ends up that he becomes a ger, and his general becomes a ger, and many, if not all, of the nation became gerim. So that was also questioned for a while, until it actually came out that there was historic evidence for a nation of Khazars, which was in the Turkey area, that there was a dynasty of kings who were Jewish, who had become gerim. This, according to what I understand, again, I'm not a historian, but according to what I understand, this became completely established beyond doubt. Yet, it still doesn't mean that this was actually the story. I just met this Shabbos at the German's Bar Mitzvah. There's a very interesting Jew here by the name of Rabbi Chaim Eisen, who is specifically an expert on Khuzari. I met him here at the Kiddush. So I came over to him. Someone introduced me to him, said, "Oh, you're giving a shiur on Khuzari? This person is the Khuzari man. He's a reincarnation of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi." So I said to him, "Well, I don't know what that tells me. Did Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi write the Khuzari?" So he told me, "This is very interesting. I just heard this week. I don't know what to make of it. I still wouldn't call this 100%. But he told me that they recently discovered a letter somewhere in Cairo. I don't know. I guess there are places where you discover letters. And they recently discovered a letter of a correspondence between Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and a friend of his, Rabbi Chalfon, apparently from Cairo, which Rabbi Chalfon asked Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, "Why is it that you didn't tell me that you put out a new sefer? That you authored a new sefer?" And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi responds, he says, "I didn't tell you about it because I didn't take it so seriously. There's a certain person," I guess the person who told this, Rabbi Chalfon, "who's mishabach kol shtus sheyotze mitachas yadi. There's some person who praises anything ridiculous that comes out of my hands." So in other words, he's kind of poking fun at his own work. And he says, "But yes, I have the sefer and I'll give it to you, I'll send it to you." So Rabbi Eisen inferred from this letter that obviously Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi must have been the actual author. Because even if you could say, well, still, who said he authored it, maybe he just compiled it, but he wouldn't have poked fun at it. If it wasn't really his work, he wouldn't have poked fun at it. The fact that he poked fun at it kind of indicates that he really was the author. Maybe. I don't consider any of these things absolutely final, because the way these things always work is that you have a few more years go by and then another discovery is made. Turns out that the letter was a fake. Turns out that this. Turns out that. I don't know. But this is really, really the only reason I'm saying all this is, once again, because it has to be addressed, not because I really think it's very important to answer this question. I'll just add a couple of more points that kind of do lend credency to the assumption that Rabbi Yitzchak HaSageri never existed. And that is that the word HaSageri is a little too convenient to be coincidental. The word Sangeri means an advocate. He was an advocate of Jewish values. Coincidental, it happens to be the name of the one who had this whole machloikis. I would assume that it was a fictional name put innovated for this purpose. There are also other indications that it actually was Rabbi Yehuda Levi who wrote it. It's also Rabbi Eisen told me, and I saw it also put in some of the Mefarshim of the Kuzari, a few of the different philosophical concepts that he uses, and also some of the historic figures that he mentions, could have only worked at his time. Because again, we're assuming that there was a 400 year gap between the debate and the production of the Sefer. A lot of the Sefer addresses Aristotelian philosophy, which really just spread later, and there are also different figures that are mentioned throughout the Sefer that really became famous later, which all also lend support to the assumption that Rabbi Yehuda Levi really was the author of the Sefer.
What if it's
in the
Sefer? What's that?
No, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, in the Sefer itself, it says this is a debate that took place 400 years ago. Now, if we'll assume there was Yehuda Levi who made the Sefer and wrote it in a fictional form, we'll have to explain that yes, there was this king of Kuzars, this kingdom of Kuzars, and he kind of drew on that to present this, to present the story. Okay, so Lamaisa, for argument's sake, not in an authoritative way, I'm going to proceed on the assumption that Rabbi Yehuda Levi was the author of the Sefer. That's how I'm going to refer to it throughout our limud of the Sefer. And if you prove otherwise, doesn't mean much to me. Maybe it's different. I'm not saying this as a psak. That's what I'm going to do for practicality. He may have. No. No, the fact that the story part of the Kuzari occupies about 0.03% of the Sefer's content. That's approximate. Okay? It's not a storybook. We're going to see soon that it's really not a storybook. It's absolutely a Sefer Kodesh. It's one of the most fundamental Sfarim on Jewish thought that we have and on understanding Jewish life. It's definitely a Sefer Kodesh. What's that? I'm not sure how those definitions work. I call it Torah. Yeah. Okay. Yehuda Levi was in the mid 1100s. Yeah, he was a father-in-law of the Eben Ezra. He was Eben Ezra's father-in-law. So that well establishes him as a Rishon. Yeah. Oh, so that's what I'm getting to next, right? Now the nature of the Sefer itself, this is what more interests me than everything I've discussed up to now. Up to now I really kind of felt like I was being Yotzi Dechoiva. Now we'll get on to the Sefer itself. So number one, like Rav Shlomo just pointed out, this is a Sefer of a Rishon. Sfarim of Rishonim are very different than Sfarim of Achronim in one very basic way. Achronim spelled out what they wanted. Rishonim basically hinted. Very, very cryptic. You have to put a lot of effort into really, also it's phrased in a very philosophical and poetic way. Sometimes you can lose the profundity of what's being said in the beauty of the way it's turned. Poetic language. And you could just kind of get swept away with the beauty of it that you lose the content, especially since the content is presented almost in a cold way and you really sometimes have to just let a phrase sit with you for a few days until it suddenly hits you, the profundity of what's actually being said here. And yes, like Rav Shlomo said, we're medayikit. many of the earlier authorities said that Kuzri is a sefer that you have to learn with the approach that he did not waste words. This is a long sefer, but he didn't waste words. And you have to carefully note the phrases that he uses and try to get from the messages what is he trying to convey.
Now, why can't you attribute that to the person that translated it?
Well, the truth is, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was very poetic, as we all know. But you're right. The truth is, for our purposes, the sefer that we know is the translator's sefer. The same goes for Kovitz Alvavitz. But what I'll say is this. First of all, the translator himself was a Rishon. We're talking about a contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam. He also translated, but it's the same family, father and son, translated the Rambam's Perush HaMishnayos. They were very... I'm a translator by profession. I'm in good company if I say that I'm the same job as the same job as they are. But they're a very, very prestigious family of translators who, lemaisa, for us, are Rishayim. That's why, for example, there have been... people have translated Chovitz HaLevavos again, for example, from the original Aramaic, which has a lot of pluses to it. But one thing I'll say in favor of learning the old version, even if it might be a little more archaic, etc., is that it's this old version that all of the great people of generation went nuts over. And we don't know if the translator himself managed to convey things because of his own input. But okay, now let's get on to the nature of the Sefer itself. What is Kuzari trying to do? So it's not just an issue of proving the Jewish faith. That is kind of a peripheral part of the Sefer, even though it's a very important part of what he's doing. It's a peripheral part of the Sefer. Really what he's doing is teaching us the significance of Yiddishkeit. A little bit more specifically, basically the theme of the Sefer, if we're going to try to sum it up, the theme of the Sefer is showing how the only real way to serve Hashem is by completely conforming to his dictates, meaning there is no such thing as a human being trying to figure out how it's appropriate to serve Hashem, because only Hashem knows. And Hashem does have an agenda for us. He provided us with tools to use toward that agenda and instructions. By tools I mean the Torah, Eretz Yisrael, Lashon HaKodesh, history, our history, other things we'll see. And by using the tools in the best way possible and applying them to the mitzvahs in the best way possible, we actually connect with Hashem. We bring Hashem on us. That's really the theme of the Sefer. Again, summing up, Kuzari is kind of like an oxymoron, because as we said, we're going to be doing the opposite the whole time. We're going to be viewing every sentence we read as a concise summary of a much broader idea. But if we want to give a general theme to what the Sefer is trying to do, this is what the Sefer is trying to do. One other point that I want to bring out before we actually begin is the perspective on the Sefer, meaning the way it was related to by the Gdolei HaDoros. There's a pretty harsh statement made at the end that one of the Mefarshim here cites at the end of his introduction, which is quoted in many places. It's not clear who actually said it. It's obviously somebody from very early times, because it's quoted by early people. We know that in that period there were a lot of works being put on what we'll call Jewish philosophy. And some of them were written based on the on conforming to the philosophical axioms or the philosophical principles that they were using at that time, Aristotle and others, and trying to approach the Torah from that perspective and make it work. We know, for example, that Rambam and Maran Avuchim wrote things that were later deemed controversial by later authorities, such as the Rashba, the Ravid, the Rivash, the Vilna Gaon, etc., which very much stems from the fact that the Rambam was not privy to Kabbalah. The advent of the Zohar was after the Rambam's time. It was kind of not really known until then. Kabbalah was in a very, very, very limited line of people from when it ended, basically in the time of Chazal, until it again burst out with the discovery of the Zohar. And that line passed the Rambam. That line missed the Rambam. This, and therefore, there were aspects of Kabbalah which are absolute. Absolutes in Yiddishkeit, which the Rambam wasn't aware of, and didn't work with them, and therefore sometimes went in a different direction. Now, by saying this, we have to realize that when we're talking about the Rambam, this is not a disclaimer. This is the absolute. To realize that we're talking about greatness that's beyond our comprehension. And it's on the contrary. It's not just that, okay, you know, the Zohar was discovered after the Rambam's time, so, okay, he didn't have it, and now we know things that the Rambam didn't know. No. There's hashgacha here at work. I'll put it the way Rav Shimshon Pinkus put it down. My own words. There's hashgacha here at work. There's Kabbalah. Kabbalah means that you're actually being spoon-fed the deeper secrets and the conceptualization of Yiddishkeit the way it was conveyed at Sinai. But besides Kabbalah, there's the human intellect. Human intellect is a power that's immense, and it's not appreciated enough by us in our times. When I talk about human intellect, I'm not just talking about the Rambam's immense intellect, I'm talking about our intellect. Human intellect, Chavos HaVavos says, is one of the sources of Emes. Chavos HaVavos says that there are three sources of Emes: Torah Shebiksav, Torah Shebal Peh, Chazal, and pure, unbiased human intellect. It's a source of Emes. There was a period in history where Hashem Dafka did not want Kabbalah to be available, so that the human intellect, we should get the fruits of the human intellect maximized, pushed to its maximum. This produced the works of the Rambam, of the Ralbag, of the, and the Kuzari, the Chavos HaLevavos. These were all the fruits of this period. At the same time, when Kabbalah did emerge, it was necessary to reject some of the ideas that were developed at that time. That's something we're not going to get into in full detail now. But what I will say is, and this is really for the purpose of approaching the Kuzari, even the Mekubalim, the great Mekubalim, who came later, namely, let's say the Vilna Gaon, said that Kuzari was absolutely in line with everything. And the way it's termed here, which is, I'm not going to quote the full quote because I don't even dare say it, but I'll quote part of the quote, is that Divrei HaRambam Kroivim Ela Emes Yesu Min HaSheker. The Rambam's words are closer to truth than to falsehood. Then there's another great name, and I'm not going to say, which this person said, Kroivim Ela Sheker Yesu Min HaEmes, closer to falsehood than to truth. And I'm not going to say it. If you want, you can look it up, but I'm not going to say it. Divrei HaKuzari Kulam Emes. The Kuzari is 100% true. Which basically means the Kuzari withstood all the criticism of the subsequent generations, and everyone who came later said Kuzari was all there. It's all there. And therefore, for example, the Vilna Gaon recommended, instead of Chavos HaLevavos, which is also an unbelievable work, which was the product of human intellect, begins with Shara Yichud, which also there, he philosophically bases Hashem's oneness. The Gaon said, instead of learning that, learn Kuzari. That's what the Gaon said. Instead of learning that, learn Kuzari. It's known that there are different approaches. Many people say that today we shouldn't learn Shara Yichud. Begin Chavos HaLevavos after Shara Yichud. And the Gaon said to learn Kuzari instead. So this, I just wanted to give a little bit of a perspective to appreciate what it is that we're doing, what the nature of the Sefer that we're about to learn. I'll also add that both Shlomo Volbe, well, it's already been stated by much earlier authorities, but both Shlomo Volbe and Rabbi Avigdor Miller said that a person who wants to consider himself a fully rounded Jew has to know Sefer Kuzari. Okay, now let's start. Amar Yehuda ben Shaul, Amar HaMechaber. Yehuda ben Shaul said that the author said, okay, see above. Sha'ol Shalu Oisi Al Masheyesh Iti. I've been asked, regarding the information that I have. Minatanos vachuvos alacholkim aleinu minafalosim vanshatos. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, many people have approached me and have asked me. They know that I have information about refutations against the philosophers, or in modern terms, the atheists and the other religions, chutz min ha-noitrin, besides the Christians, v'alaminim ha-cholkim al ha-moin Yisrael, and also against the apikosim who disagree with the general consensus of Klal Yisrael. Here he's referring to Jewish apikosim. Already at that time we had Jewish apikosim. He's referring to the Karaites, the Jews who believed only in Torah Shemiksav. So many people have asked me about these things. V'zochati ma sheshmativ kvar nitano yisachover, and therefore I invoked what I had heard of the different arguments of the Jewish Chacham asher hoya etzel melech Kuza, who was in the court of the king of Kuza, hanichnas b'das ha-Yehudim ha-Yoyim ka-Rabam Yerushan. Everybody knows about the king of Kuza, who at this time, it's been 400 years since the king of Kuza with the heads of his state became Jews, and I have records of the discussions between him and the Jewish Chacham. As is well known in historic records, the whole story of the Khuzar kingdom. Now, what was the story of this king? This king, as we said, was a very sincere person. A person who sought to do the right thing. This person, as we'll see soon, he was a devout Khuzari believer, whatever their religion was. He was a devout Khuzari believer. And he kept on having this recurrent dream, as though there was a malach talking to him, and told him, your intent is indeed pleasing to Hashem, to the Creator, but the way you're going about it is wrong. It's not pleasing to Hashem. Your intent is right. Your ways of going about it are wrong. Vehu. Now, what were his ways of going about it? What was this king about? Vehu aya mishtadel me'od b'toras ha-kuza. He was very devout about the Khuzar religion. Ad shehaya mishamesh ba'avodas ha'eichel va'korbanos ba'atzmoy. He was a very pious king. He personally served in the Khuzar temple, and he offered the sacrifices, etc., belev shalem, with his whole heart. He was his whole being, his whole essence was simply trying to please the Creator. The kol asher haya mishtadel b'maaseh, but as intense as his efforts were, haya marach ba'il of balayli, he kept on getting this dream at night. A marach would come and tell him, oimeloi, would tell him, kavanoscha ritzuya u'maasecha eino ritzuya. Your heart is in the right place. Your intent is right. But what you're doing is wrong, and it's not pleasing to the Creator. So this person knew no rest. This caused him to investigate all the different faiths and religions. And ultimately, he, along with many of the Khuzari, much of the Khuzari nation, became Jews. And yes, the arguments that the Jewish Chacham made to him were things that he felt comfortable with. And he felt that they were intellectually sound. And therefore I decided to record these things, to put them down as the discussion took place, and let the wise take it from there. He's talking to us. Okay, so the truth is that before the Sefer even begins, when we began the Sefer, the Khuzari has already made his first point. which is obvious to us, but at the same time, it's a good idea to highlight it. It's not enough to have the right intent. It's not enough for your heart to be in the right place. That's the first thing that we're seeing here. This was a person who simply wanted to please God. And you'll hear many people say, and obviously I know none of us are holding here, but I still want to stress this, because this can be brought home to no end. That each person has their way of doing it. As long as your heart is in the right place, anything is acceptable. Each person serves God in his way. Yeah, and the truth is, right? Like Rav Shlomo is saying, Chazal tell us that. All Hashem is interested in is in your heart. Now, but we're seeing that it's not so. The way I forgot who it was, about Arya Kaplan maybe, who said that in other religions, it's not. No, sorry. The way he put it was, we don't serve God in our way. We serve God in His way. That's the idea. Now, what that means is as follows: if there's really such a thing as God, if there really is such a thing, you take Him for real. You take Him seriously, and it's not just fluff. It's not just something spiritual. That means that He's a real being, and He actually has a mind, so to speak. Okay, doesn't have a mind the way we do. He has a mind. He has His own ideas, and therefore, wouldn't it be a good idea to know what they are? If Hashem is real, if you do take it seriously, how can you claim to take it seriously but say, I'm not even going to conceive of the possibility that He has His ideas of how I should serve Him? I'll figure out what feels good, what feels right, and I'll do that. You're a human being, you're acknowledging that there's a God. That means that you're acknowledging that all of your intellect and all of your feelings are a tiny fraction of what He is. So how can you even claim to be establishing a relationship with God based on the way I see it? In no real... Now, but what do we do with the fact that at the end of the day it sounds right? Your heart needs to be in the right place. Rachman Alima Bay, Chazal said, all he needs is the heart. But the truth is, let's think about it for a minute. It's true. Your heart needs to be in the right place. We said this in the Gemara the other day, but I want to repeat it now, elaborate a little more. The truth is that when you're not talking fluff, when you're talking about a real relationship, the saying that it begins and ends with the heart being in the right place is simply an escape. It's not true. For example, are you a family man? You're a husband? You're married? What if you tell your wife, look, hon, I'm not going to work anymore. I'm going to lie in bed, but you know how much I love you. And believe me, love is everything. It's the heart that counts. Nothing can overcome. With love, we can get through hunger. And you can give a whole beautiful exposition that she might fall for until she gets hungry. Right? With love, we can get through everything. No. Love has to translate into something in order for it to be real. But forget that. Okay. Say, okay, food. We all understand that it's a real need. But when it comes to Hashem, let's say we're told to do chukim, right? We're told to do different things that we don't see the need for them. How could there be something morally important about them? Let's take a chayk. Okay? We understand the Nodam al-Chaveira is very, very important. We can understand the beauty of other certain mitzvahs. But let's say shatnez. I come and I tell you, in the context of your relationship with Hashem, doing shatnez, you have to be a bad person to do it. It's morally wrong. It's not just that it's an Aveira, you'll get in trouble if you do it. It's a disgusting thing to do. You're a despicable person if you do it. It's hard to connect to that in an emotional way. Okay, I understand there's something high and spiritual about it. But how can you say something that doesn't seem... There's nothing emotionally wrong with it. How could it be evil? How could it be wicked? But let's come back to the husband and the wife. Sometimes there could be things that you cannot fathom as being hurtful, or the opposite, something you cannot fathom as really making a difference to somebody, and yet you have to take it on blind faith that they do. I'll give an example. I still can't believe that flowers are better than a good supper. It's beyond me. I don't understand what purpose is. You put them on the table. We have a picture of flowers in our living room anyways. So you gotta take live flowers, you put them on the table. They're gonna wilt after a couple of days. It's really hard for me to connect to the fact that I'm doing something beautiful by bringing home flowers. But I have to take it on blind faith. My wife says, wonder of wonders, it really, really changes her day. It changes her day. She doesn't always want... Right. That's right.
What if I said coming and giving her a real big smile and saying, how was her day? And putting her first. Even if you don't feel it, it's more important than the material item.
Absolutely. You're right. And that's why at the end of the day, you have to, you certainly can't neglect. You can't come in with a sour face. You say, you know what, hon? You like flowers? Every 2 weeks, there'll be flowers on the table. My grandfather, my mother said that on her parents' anniversary, she would get a panicked call from my grandfather. He would call from the office. He forgot about the anniversary. He would call and he'd say, my mother was already married at the time. He'd say, it's mommy's anniversary tonight. And I forgot about it. Can you arrange something? And she would call the florist and have them deliver flowers with love from daddy. So what happens if I do it simpler than that? I'll tell my wife, look, hon, I'm going to call the florist, and I'll tell him every 25th of the month, there will be a bouquet on the table. Of course, the flowers have to express the inner feeling. And we'll see soon. Yes, all the mitzvahs, their value is in the inner feelings that they express, just like the flowers. But here we're starting to see the idea that, yes, there could be things that I don't relate to at all, and yet they are morally correct. They're emotionally correct. Or, an example of the negative, a loisa say, a choik. This also. I'm a decent guy. I have to say so if the shiurim are being recorded. And I know the importance of shalom bayis. And therefore, even though it's not all that important to me that the house be spick and span and perfectly neat all the time, we do that. To my wife, it's important. But I'm going to tell you the truth here now, is that it really took a long time. I always cleaned up, helped with, keep the upkeep, the cleanliness in the house. It really took a long time until it dawned on me that a messy house is really, I won't say the word painful, it's a little too strong. But really disturbing, meaning, I'll use a different mushroom and then we'll get back to the house. Is there something morally wrong with scratching a blackboard? Is there anything morally wrong with that? Nothing wrong with morally wrong with that. Now, does anybody here like to hear a blackboard scratched? Okay, now let's say you have a person who doesn't... Is there anybody here who doesn't get the chills when you hear a blackboard scratched? Does it bother you if you hear a blackboard scratched? Doesn't bother you. You're probably the only one in the crowd. Now, so you don't know, you really can't relate to what we're talking about if we say that scratching a blackboard just gives us a lousy feeling. But it really does. So now, let's say you know that. Scratching a blackboard doesn't bother you in the least. But there are a whole bunch of people sitting here and they're telling you, please don't do it. Why? It just creates a lousy feeling. Why? Is it something personal? It's nothing personal here. I'm not... Please don't do it! And he goes ahead and he does it because he can't relate to it. Is there something wrong with that? Something morally wrong with that. You can't relate to it, but there's an experience that you're not experiencing, but it's a real experience. There's something wrong. There's a bad feeling that's created by the blackboard being scratched. So please don't do it.
I think if I were a guy, it was basically set up that for that the mitzvahs I would plant within man's head, you know, like a certain connection that they would naturally have to it, and not, I mean, I understand maybe one or two chukim.
You're asking a question. Why is it? You know, okay, let's just first finish developing this thought, and then you're asking a very good question that we should address. So in other words, no, let me just finish this point. So in other words, it took me time to chap that for my wife, a dirty house is a scratching blackboard. I always thought it's nicer if it's clean. But let's say, you know, it's tight before Shabbos, there's a lot of things to do. Why does that have to be priority number one? Until it suddenly hit me, that's a blackboard being scratched. She's going to sit in the Shabbos Suda with a scratching blackboard the whole time. I can't relate to it at all. It's a chayk, which is emotionally correct, it's morally binding. I understand that I'm not a mensch if I don't keep this chayk. Right? Now, just a minute. So yes, we're seeing that even in interpersonal relationships, there are chukim. If you don't keep those chukim, you aren't a mensch. It's not an issue of religion. Right? My wife grew up in a home where they believed that a missing house is wrong. It's not the issue. It's an issue of being a mensch, of really not causing distress. So therefore, we can't come and say, why should this be important to Hashem? That's the same as saying, I don't see anything wrong with a blackboard being scratched, and therefore I'm not going to do it. Now, here we come to the question you asked. Does Hashem get nauseous when a blackboard is scratched? Hashem doesn't get nauseous from blackboards being scratched. He doesn't get nauseous from anything. So, where does this idea come in? But the answer is that, again, if we're assuming that Hashem is a real thing, not just a fluffy concept, then, yes, there are ideas that Hashem has that we might not be able to relate to. And, yes, there are certain mitzvahs that Hashem gave us an emotional connection to. Mitzvah of tzedakah, Hashem gave us an emotional connection to. Mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. There are certain mitzvahs of Bein Adam Lamakim that Hashem gave us an emotional connection to. And there are certain mitzvahs that Hashem did not give us an emotional connection to. So now you're asking, why not? Why couldn't Hashem give us an emotional connection to those mitzvahs too? And the answer is that part of the value of a relationship is being able to relate to the other person knowing that I don't understand. I value what? Being able to relate to the other person. Just like, I would say, this is my guess, okay, that the reason it's like this with interpersonal relationships is in order to make it real for us. Part of the quality of the relationship is that I'm able to understand that there are things that you're going to ask of me that I can't relate to, and I'm just going to do them because I know they're important for you. I don't know why. I might not even know how important they are, what the extent of it is, because I can't connect to it at all. But I know it's important to you. And therefore, Hashem, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say, going into this point, yeah. I think that asking why didn't, you know, what does Hashem get upset if we scratch the blackboard? I think that knowing something, let's say with your wife or my wife, and then learning to say she likes a nice house, and therefore I will accommodate that, I think is not enough. I think that understanding, there are certain women, I'm sure, are not mocked on cleanliness in the home.
Every relationship will have its dynamics, but every relationship will have the dynamics in which we have to relate to things that we can't relate to.
Right. But one of the things that I learned was that what I learned was just as we were when we were boys, some of us growing up loved cars, and some of us might have like wanted to really clean the car, shine the car, and get upset if somebody came in the car and dirtied the car. It was our dollars.
Yeah.
So a house. The
house is the woman's domain. That's true. That's a very hush of a point. I don't want to spend too much time on it now because that's true. But the truth is that, on the contrary, you're explaining the depth behind the idea that a woman wants cleanliness in her home. Yeah. So the truth is, you're right. In one way, we can say that it's like that with the chukim as well. On the other hand, we'll say that whatever the case is, every relationship between man and wife, father and son, brother and sister, friend and friend, there will be the dynamics that are chukim, and you just have to relate to no matter what. I'll give another example. Is we live in a green world today, right? Green generation. Right? There's a new value system that basically came up with, people ran out of all values. There had to be something, so he came up with a new value system. Now, I'm not completely undermining the chashivas. There might be certain elements of the green campaigns that have some peripheral value in Yiddishkeit. There are some. But in a big way, that's basically what it is. It's an attempt to fill a void. But forget that for a minute. Let's talk on the theoretical level. Let's say that the whole green campaign is really, really very important. If we're not careful about it, by Motzei Shabbos, the ozone layer is going to be gone, we're going to be burnt to a crisp. Okay? So now, let's say you would come and tell a person 100 years ago, remember, what's his name? The vice president, the big green guy. Dan Quayle? No, Gore, Al Gore. Yeah. Al Gore. What happened? He was awarded the Nobel Prize for his efforts in pushing the color green. So he traveled to, where was it? Norway, is that where it is? And there he got the prize. They came to pick him up in a limousine. And he refused to travel in the limousine. Why? Because of the exhausts that are having a negative effect on the ozone layer. How he explains his flight, I don't know. But whatever. We won't bother with that right now. What's that? He's above the ozone layer. That must be it. Okay. He went with an electrical plane. Fine. Now, let's say that it was a very, very important step that he took. That limousine ride was going to make it or break it. I want to use this as a mushel now. I completely scorn what he did. But I want to use this as a mushel right now. Assuming that he was right. Someone standing on the side can look at it and say, this guy made 100 people meshuga because he didn't want to drive in a limousine. Is that right? What's wrong with driving in a limousine? I don't see anything wrong with it. But on the other hand, you come and say, 1 minute, that's because you don't know the bigger picture. You have never really researched the whole environment issue. You don't realize how pressing of an issue the ozone layer is. Again, I don't want to keep repeating that, I'm just kidding. But I'm talking the Marshall level. You don't realize how pressing the ozone issue is. And therefore, to you, it seems like he wasn't a mensch. But the truth is that if he would have done the opposite, he wouldn't be a mensch. If he would have gone in that car and accommodated their wishes and made things simpler, he wouldn't be a mensch. Right? Here's another example of chukim. There are chukim. A person who's just living with his own intellect, so I can't see the harm in a car ride. Someone who has a bigger picture, someone who studied the topic in depth, might say, you don't see the harm. And you think that it's less menschlich to make people crazy. But I see, I know the bigger picture. I know that what you're doing here is much more destructive than the fact that you made people crazy for an extra 15 minutes, you took them out of their way. So, therefore, we're getting lessons in the physical world. The Mekubalim say, by the way, that in the modern day, we're being illustrated all kinds of concepts of spirituality in the material world. This is an example of that. Things that would be harder to relate to in earlier times, were being illustrated in this time. You see how, yes, there can be many issues of menschlichkeit, of being a mensch, of being decent, not about being religious, being decent in areas that you simply cannot understand. Why should there be something wrong with this? Or why should there be something so right with this? And therefore, we have to say, Hashem is not any more fluffy than anybody else you have a relationship with. Hashem is not any less real. If He is for real, you have to realize that now you're dealing with a whole value system that you can't begin to relate to. So you have to take your word for it. If He says, there's something called paraduma, and if you use a cow with 3 black hairs instead of 2, you aren't a mensch. You're a disgusting person. How could you? Right? It's an emotional issue. That's the...
I
think what makes the mashal different and what makes it harder over here is kind of like, I guess you call it like a double, it's like a snake, I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but essentially, like, first of all, you have to have a Yonah Hashem. Then you have to know that, you know, Hashem is Torah from Sinai.
Right.
And then on top of that, you have to say, okay, and I'm going to do things which make no sense to me.
That's right.
Know, so
he's kind of working backwards.
Like working with your wife, you know, like
that's
your wife,
true.
She's sitting there in front of you.
You're right. You're right. We're skipping steps here. He's working backwards here. He's starting with the fundamental that if you want to have a relationship with God, you have to relate to Him in His way. You have to work on His grounds. And that's He's saying, number one. Soon He's going to get to Torah from Sinai. But number one is God, is it fluff or is it real? If it's real, then realize that the real means a whole real system there that can include an awful lot of things that are beyond you. So make it your business to go figure out what He wants. Don't just come along and say, well, I can't relate to God at all, but I have an idea of what He probably likes and what He probably doesn't like. If you're for real, if you really take it seriously, go figure it out. What are His terms? Okay, we'll stop here. Continue Bezos Hashem next week.